Hi, I'm Gary from Stonyfield, the organic yogurt company. Our organic yogurt business supports 200,000 acres of organic family farms. So we're proud to support thoughtful programming like Living on Earth, and hope you will too. Donate at loe.org.
More people own cats and dogs in the United States than voted in the last presidential election. Americans love their pets, and they like their presidents pet-friendly. If you count Andrew Johnson, who fed the mice he found in his White House bedroom, 43 of our 44 chief executives owned animals of all sizes and stripes. Living on Earth's Ike Srikandaraja has our tale.
What's the most powerful animal on Earth? A lion? A great white? Or the leader of the free world's best friend? Well, only the first dog has its own Secret Service detail.
They were always afraid it might get kidnapped or something might happen to it, so they actually had a double that would stand in for Lucky.
In 1985, Lucky was the dog with the decoy. His owners, the president and Nancy Reagan, appointed Claire McLean first groomer.
And I couldn't tell anyone I was grooming the president's dog. It was always hush-hush.
Getting the secret assignment was huge.
Oh, it was life-changing for me.
But her first cut on the first pup was a snafu.
Lo and behold, I cut a lot of the hair off and didn't find out till later that actually Mrs. Reagan thought I'd cut too much off.
McLean walked out of the White House with her tail between her legs and too much puppy coat in her arms.
But little did she know that that hair that I picked up and put in a brown paper bag and took home with me would become the foundation piece for the Presidential Pet Museum.
For the past decade, McLean, now retired, has been mining this neglected corner of American presidential history. Her Presidential Pet Museum is mostly in storage, boxes full of photos, clippings, and memorabilia. But McLean keeps a few artifacts on hand.
Now, we do have the authentic cowbell that hung around Pauline Wayne's neck. She was a Holstein cow that Howard Taft was very fond of. They called the cow his favorite pet. Would you like me to ring it for you?
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right, hang on a minute.
McLean's pet project offers a new way of understanding the White House through the eyes of the animals that live there. Take Pauline Wayne. She provided milk to the Taft family from 1910 to 1913 and was the last cow to graze at the White House, which illustrates two historical points. One, America's more rural agrarian past, and two, President Taft's appetite for dairy. The White House has been a habitat for 400 creatures. Chuck Zoeller learned their stories while researching the book First Pet, published by the Associated Press.
In contemporary times, it's mostly been dogs and the occasional cat. But in earlier years, there were definitely some offbeat animals.
President Thomas Jefferson oversaw the early exploration of the West, and some of that wild made its way back to the White House in 1807.
Jefferson received two grizzly bear cubs from Zebulon Pike, who was an explorer, and brought them back from the West.
Zebulon Pike told Jefferson that the Native Americans of the West considered the bears the most ferocious animals on the continent. Awed by the creatures, but concerned for his home's safety, Jefferson scrambled to relocate the grizzly cubs. In the meantime, they stayed with him in cages on the lawn. Jefferson's political opponents started joking that the White House had become a bear garden. Bears were brought back as White House guests under President Teddy Bear Roosevelt and Calvin Coolidge.
One of my favorites is the Coolidge administration had a small menagerie at the White House.
A bobcat, wallaby, antelope, two lions, pygmy hippos, exotic birds, and domesticated raccoons.
It's not uncommon to see photo ops from the Coolidge White House that include the raccoons in the photos.
The zoo at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue exemplified the era of the Roaring Twenties, even though the famously quiet President Coolidge did not. But he warmed around animals.
I think that's been the case for a number of presidents, that the pets associated with them make them seem a little more human and down to earth.
In early American history, exotic wild animals showed the strength of the presidency and reach of its influence. But in recent times, the White House animals proved their political worth by showing their owner's softer side. In 1952, then vice presidential candidate Nixon faced allegations of illegally using $18,000 in campaign donations. On a national broadcast, he denied the accusations.
One other thing I probably should tell you, because if I don't, they'll probably be saying this about me too.
With a hangdog expression, he confessed he had taken one donation, a Cocker Spaniel puppy.
Black and white, spotted. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checkers. And you know, the kids, like all kids, love the dog. And I just want to say this right now, that regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep it.
Checkers shielded Nixon from blame and kept him on the Eisenhower ticket that took him to the White House. It wasn't the first time a candidate had unleashed a dog to swing an election. On the campaign trail in 1944, FDR got dragged into the mud by rumors about his beloved Scottish Terrier, Fala. Opponents said FDR had left his dog on an Aleutian island and had ordered a Navy destroyer to retrieve Fala at considerable taxpayer cost.
Well, of course, I don't resent a tax. And my family don't resent a tax. But Fala does resent it.
The political attack playbook hasn't changed much through history, and the page on pets is dog-eared. Presidential candidate Mitt Romney can't seem to shake the story of him strapping his Irish setter Seamus into a crate on the roof of his car for a 12-hour drive to Canada. Even though the incident happened nearly 30 years ago, dog advocates still have a bone to pick. The howls of animal cruelty have reached the highest office before. In 1964, LBJ was photographed lifting his hound by its long ears. He cleared up his reputation with a recording.
Come on, Yuki, sit down. Come here. You want to go out and ride? You want to go to see the cattle? You want to go see them? Do you?
The duet is called Dogs Have Always Been My Friends. LBJ on lead vocals, Yuki follows.
Come on, sing for me.
In the tightly choreographed world of presidential politics, the only ones who aren't on script are the animals. And sometimes they can tell us more than the politicians they belong to. For Living on Earth, I'm Ike Sriskandaraja.
Come on, sing for me.
Living on Earth is produced by the World Media Foundation. Our crew includes Bobby Bascom, Eileen Balinski, Jessica Lise Kern, Ingrid Lobet, and Helen Palmer, with help from Sarah Calkins, Gabriella Ramino, and Sammy Souza. Our interns are Mary Bates and Sophie Golden. Jeff Turton is our technical director. Allison Lurisdeen composed our themes. You can find us anytime at loe.org, and while you're online, check out our sister program, Planet Harmony. Planet Harmony welcomes all and pays special attention to stories affecting communities of color. Log on and join the discussion at myplanetharmony.com. And don't forget to check out the Living on Earth Facebook page. It's PRI's Living on Earth. And you can follow us on Twitter at Living on Earth. That's just one word. Steve Kerwood is our executive producer. I'm Bruce Gellerman. Thanks for listening.
Funding for Living on Earth comes from the National Science Foundation, supporting coverage of emerging science. And Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt and smoothies. Stonyfield invites you to just eat organic for a day. Details at justeatorganic.com. Support also comes from you, our listeners, the Go Forward Fund, and Pax World Mutual and Exchange Traded Funds, integrating environmental, social, and governance factors into investment analysis and decision making. On the web at paxworld.com. Pax World for tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.